Sit back and watch and listen to this one inside a half minute, and the Browns will not have to snap the ball again. They will beat the Steelers in the opening round of the playoffs on a wonderful, wonderful wild card weekend. 48-37, Kansas City, here we come.
The Browns is the Browns. Is the Browns in the playoffs? Baker Mayfield and Cleveland take on Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs this weekend after Cleveland's first NFL playoff win since forever. All right, since 1994. But today, hear how a team that was once synonymous with losing changed everything. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, January 15th. This is ESPN Daily. Jake, thanks for joining me, man.
Good to be on with you, Pablo.
Jake Trotter covers the Cleveland Browns for ESPN. And before that, he reported on the Big 12 and followed Baker Mayfield's meteoric rise. So you live in Cleveland?
I live in Cleveland. I live about 5 miles away from the Browns training facility in Berea.
Ooh, so listen, you are right at the heart of everything. You cover the Browns. I want to understand, what does winning this first playoff game in 26 years and doing it against this truly hated enemy in the Pittsburgh Steelers, what does it do for a city after two decades of being, like, generally humiliated? How would you describe the energy, Jake, in Cleveland right now?
Yeah, I would describe it as one of the greatest moments in the history of the city. And I'm not just talking about football. I'm talking about all moments. If you talk to people who grew up here, they would say that Sunday was one of the happiest days of their lives. Sunday night after that win, you could hear fireworks going off around Cleveland. I don't know who has fireworks in the middle of January, but people have them apparently. People were, you know, driving up and down their streets, honking their horns. It was a very exciting night for Cleveland, and one that, you know, they've been waiting for 26 years and really forever, considering how dominated they have been by the Steelers over the years.
Yeah, I'm looking at a list of things, actually, Jake, that happened in 1994 when the Browns won their last playoff game. Turns out the number one song in the Billboard charts was The Sign by Ace of Base. Does that all sound right to you in terms of how distant all of this has been feeling?
Yeah, I've been doing this all year, checking what songs were number one at a time the Browns had a milestone. I know that when they were 4-1 for the first time since 1994, when Bill Belichick was still the head coach, that Boys to Men actually had the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100. That kind of gives you a little context of how long it's been since the Browns were at this point. I mean, their starting quarterback, for example, wasn't even alive yet.
To rewind to a little bit more recently, the week leading up to this playoff win over the Steelers, it was, I don't even know how to explain it other than just like total chaos.
Breaking news into First Take out of Cleveland. Browns coach Kevin Stefanski has tested positive for COVID-19, according to our Adam Schefter. Two other coaches and players dealing with COVID-related issues. They are closing their facilities.
Fellas. They ultimately competed with Kevin Stefanski in his basement, watching the game, not on the sidelines. So what has this week been like as it relates to COVID?
They had a practice on Wednesday, which was weird to see because they haven't had a practice or very many of them, not even just last week, for the last couple of weeks. I mean, go back to the game in week 16 when they traveled to play the Jets. They had to delay their flight because they had a positive test from one of their players. Then they had to put their entire receiving corps as high-risk close contacts on the reserve COVID-19 list. They finally get to Newark. They stay the night there. They were not able to do a walkthrough before leaving on Saturday. So they held a walkthrough on the fifth floor of the parking garage that morning, adjacent to their hotel. really from that moment until now, it has been total chaos. I mean, they have had almost every single day since then, something chaotic happened where they've had to adjust. They went the entire week last week, almost without a practice until getting one in Friday. They finally got Kevin Stefanski, their head coach, back in the building on Thursday. It has been a bizarre couple of weeks, but to this team's credit and to Kevin Stefanski's credit, they have never panicked. They have never, you know, felt sorry for themselves, and they have been able to overcome it, which I think is the most impressive thing with this team, given their lack of success in the past and the way as they've come together, their ability to overcome different curveballs that have been thrown their way.
So, Jake, the thing the Browns have to overcome this week is the defending Super Bowl champion and current Super Bowl favorite Kansas City Chiefs and their quarterback Patrick Mahomes. And they have a wide receiver, Sammy Watkins, who basically said on Twitter that the Browns are not real competition. And that comes a week after Steelers wide receiver Juju Smith-Schuster famously dismissed Cleveland by saying that the Browns is the Browns before that wild card game. So how do the Browns deal with this whole perception that they're still just the same old Browns?
They love it, and nobody loves it more than Baker Mayfield. Before the game against Pittsburgh, he put a video on his Instagram account with the title, "The Browns is the Browns." And by the way, if you drive around Cleveland now, there are billboards everywhere with the slogan, "The Browns is the Browns." It's like they've taken it and made it their slogan for the rest of the season, for the playoffs. They love being discounted. They love being disrespected. It gives them extra fuel.
We knew that everybody was counting us out, and we knew what mentality we were going to have. It was just for us to go out and do our job because no one believed in us besides us.
And really, that's the way Baker has always operated. You know, this is a guy that, you know, wasn't a five-star recruit coming out of high school, you know, was a two-time walk-on in college. So he loves the disrespect. He uses that as energy, as fuel. And I think the rest of the team follows suit.
The idea that Baker is now going to be playing in a game against a guy he has a bit of history that I didn't know about until I became aware of your reporting on this. Tell me about how Baker and Mahomes go way back.
Well, they both grew up in Texas, you know, Baker in the Austin area, Mahomes in White House, Texas, which is on the east side. And Baker was a true freshman walk-on at Texas Tech while Mahomes was a senior in high school. And actually, Baker, before he transferred to Oklahoma, hosted Mahomes on his official visit. Now, Mahomes was already committed to Tech by that point, but they have been friends ever since. They've had some unbelievable battles on the field, particularly in 2016. The 66-59 shootout between the two, where they threw for like 5 million yards.
They swing it out to Mixon. Mixon cuts it back and spins in for another OU touchdown. A new school record for Baker Mayfield with 7 touchdowns tonight.
I was there. It's the most incredible game I've ever covered in person.
Patrick Mahomes on his back foot this time. QT's all alone. It's a Texas Tech touchdown. This game is bonkers.
There were some storylines of that game that nobody remembers now. It was the first game that Baker Mayfield played back in Tech. And before the game, the students were wearing shirts with the word traitor on them. They were cursing at him. And I remember on the sideline watching Baker, and I just had the feeling he was going to have a monster game. And he was basically perfect. But Mahomes that night was otherworldly.
End zone, blown coverage, touchdown, Texas Tech still breathing. As Mahomes has tied the NCAA record for passing yards in a game now with 734.
When you factor in that Pat had a shoulder sprain on his throwing shoulder and a fractured wrist, and he still threw for more than 700 yards, he still broke the FBS record with more than 800 yards of total offense, is one of the more incredible things I've ever seen. And I remember being in the visitor's tunnel, and Baker and I were talking about the game, and he asked me, like, what records did Pat break? I said, Baker, I think he broke all of the records. You might have broken them yourself if it weren't for him. So a lot of mutual respect there on both sides. And, you know, I think they really respect each other's game.
And Jake, it's worth noting that you go back with Baker, probably more than anybody else at ESPN, I would dare say. What's your relationship with him? How far back does that go?
Yeah, it goes back to Baker Mayfield's very first college start when he was at Texas Tech, when he became the first walk-on true freshman to start for a Power 5 program. And I had actually just started covering the Big 12 that season. And so my first assignment, really my very first assignment, was covering SMU versus Texas Tech in Dallas in Baker's first start. And I think I broke the story the night before that Baker was, you know, this guy out of nowhere who had won the starting job. Nobody had heard of, nobody had recruited, and, you know, covered him throughout Texas Tech that season, covered his transfer to Oklahoma. I remember we were talking on the phone and he told me he was going to OU, and the Sooners had just had this guy, Trevor Knight, beat Alabama in the Sugar Bowl as a redshirt freshman. And it wasn't my place to say it, but I almost wanted to say, Baker, if you go to OU, you are never going to play again. They've already got their quarterback. But he knew better than I did about his self-belief in what he was capable of.
I'm curious, given your vantage point with Baker, how has he sort of changed over the years since leaving college and now being obviously the leader of this team?
I would say the biggest change I have seen in Baker has come this year. He's still the guy that has that chip on his shoulder, that edge, but I think he's channeled it a little bit differently. You know, he's a little bit more subtle about it. You don't see it on the front of ESPN.com like you did last year, seemingly every week. I've talked to him about leadership, and one thing he told me at the end of last season, he said, I got to learn to be the same leader every day. Regardless of what's going on, if things are going badly, you know, I got to be the same guy. If I'm not playing well, I can't let that affect me. And, you know, he'd be the first one to tell you that it did last year. And this year, it's been a completely different story. And you've seen this team take Baker's lead.
All right, coming up, the roots of a turnaround in Cleveland and whether they can hold.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Jake, you've been covering this team for two seasons now, really in this new ascendancy, and the franchise had been so bad, as we established, for so long. So based on what you've heard from players past and present, why is this team so different than all of the previous ones?
Yeah, it's a combination of factors. I would say, number one, they are all on the same page. If you look at the recent history of the Browns, going back to when they came back to the league in 1999, there's always been infighting. There's always been power struggles. You know, a coach gets fired, then the GM gets fired, then they have a new quarterback. And it's like a cycle that they could not break themselves out of. And even last year, there was a lot of that going on. So I think, to ownership's credit, what they were able to do this year, and this was the buzzword they used leading up to all the hires they made, alignment. Everybody is on the same page, from Paul D. Podesta, the chief strategy officer, to Andrew Berry, the new general manager, to Kevin Stefanski, to the assistants to Baker Mayfield at quarterback, and all the other players. And I think that has made a huge difference for them. Also, on top of that, they did a fantastic job addressing their weaknesses. They went from having one of the worst offensive lines in the NFL to boasting one of the best. They signed Jack Conklin, the top right tackle on the market. They spent the number 10 overall pick on Jedrick Wills out of Alabama at left tackle. So just the moves that they made were really smart, shored up their weaknesses. It's not a perfect team by any means, but it is a really good team that knows who they are. And I think that starts all the way from Andrew Berry, the general manager, to the players in the locker room.
Is there a story or an anecdote, Jake, that you think of, or maybe even reported yourself, that sort of summarizes the before times, what like ineptitude over the last two decades looked like?
I've only been here two seasons, but I can't imagine there is a crazier Cleveland Browns season than the 2019 one. The last time I was on The Daily was with Mina, was after the Denver Broncos game in the middle of last season. Cleveland lost to fall to 2-6 and had become the biggest disappointment in the NFL given all the preseason hype. But the game was memorable for all these bizarre things that were happening off the field. I mean, you had Odell Beckham Jr., who was wearing non-compliant cleats with a clown face on them, where the NFL told him, "Is if you don't change your cleats, you're not coming out in the second half." Baker Mayfield inexplicably shaved his face three times from the moment got to the stadium to the moment he left.
Take a look at Baker Mayfield showing up in Denver, full beard going on. Then in the middle of the game, sort of a goatee look. And then post-game, he goes Nacho Libre on us. That's three shaves and one touchdown in one day. Come on, man.
And then Jermaine Whitehead, starting safety for the Browns, who had had some missed tackles in that game, he's in his locker. I'm watching this unfold in real time. At his locker, on his phone, tweeting death threats to fans. Actually tweeting death threats to somebody who's on the Browns postgame show. And by the time that he got to the bus to leave Denver, his Twitter account had already been suspended. He was released the next day. And that kind of insanity was not that abnormal. It was almost like if you talk to people with the team, they were like dreading what was going to happen. This is the biggest compliment that I can give Kevin Stefanski and the rest of the team. They're kind of boring this year. They're not really that dramatic. And I think that's been a big part of the turnaround.
So with Stefanski, I want to understand better, how did he get here? How did he become this particularly good fit for this team? Stylistically, what distinguishes him within this building?
Yeah, I mean, I think number one, Paul DePodesta, who led the coaching search this time around, wanted to bring in Stefanski last year. They ultimately went with Freddie Kitchens, who, you know, with Baker had really flourished toward the end of Baker's rookie season. When that didn't work out after the 2019 season and John Dorsey, the general manager, was gone as well, it kind of fell on Paul to spearhead this search. And so that's how Stefanski got back in the mix. And I think one thing that happened that was really important for this team that really laid a foundation was before the world changed in March with the Rudy Gobert, Oklahoma City Thunder, Tom Hanks night, Stefanski was able to fly to Austin and meet with Baker in person and meet his family. And it just so happened, Kevin Stefanski's dad, Ed Stefanski, who's an executive with the Detroit Pistons, just so happened to be in Austin scouting. And so it really created a family atmosphere between the Stefanskis and the Mayfields. And, you know, with Baker, he's extremely loyal, you know, to his guys. And I think they started that trust right there. And it was really important because if they had waited, maybe that meeting doesn't happen. You know, maybe the foundation is a little bit different.
So I want to understand the dynamic also, Jake, between Andrew Berry, the 33-year-old youngest GM in the league, and John Dorsey. John Dorsey being the former GM, famously on Hard Knocks. That's where I sort of began to truly appreciate the character of John Dorsey, at least. Who gets credit for everything that's happening here?
Well, at the end of the day, John Dorsey drafted a lot of the guys on this team. He drafted Baker Mayfield. He drafted Denzel Ward. He drafted Nick Chubb. So I think that he deserves credit for where this team is to some degree. At the same time, you know, there were some holes in the team that Dorsey put together. We can litigate the Odell Beckham trade and whether that was the right move for the team. We can talk about how poor of an offensive line Dorsey put in front of Baker Mayfield and how that hindered his development. But you can't say that John Dorsey didn't do a good job drafting, because he brought in some blue chip players that are going to be the foundation of this team for years to come. Here's the thing. If Cleveland loses to Kansas City, it'll be disappointing, but the window is wide open for years to come. All these guys are young. All these guys are under contract. They finally have the head coach that they've been looking for. And the Cleveland Browns, they're not going anywhere anytime soon.
Jake, it's crazy that all of this is happening without Odell Beckham Jr., at least to me, because that guy's theoretically the best or one of the best receivers in the league, but the Browns clearly have thrived in his absence. So what's the postmortem on Odell? Or is it even possible to do a postmortem at this point in time?
Well, he's still a member of the Cleveland Browns, and he's still under contract, and he's going to be virtually impossible to trade in the offseason because he's still going to be rehabbing back from the knee injury. It is confusing. It really defies logic because, like you said, Odell is a fabulous player, and you would think as a quarterback, when you got a playmaker like that at wide receiver, it can only help you. But, you know, sometimes things just don't work out. It's nobody's fault. The chemistry is not there. And by the way, the chemistry between Odell and Baker in the locker room has been great from the beginning. Mm. That's not the issue. It's on the field. And I wrote about it the week after Odell got hurt. This was my feeling and my analysis of the situation that Baker was going to be better off without Odell.
Mm.
It was really difficult to pinpoint, but I think we have a sample size here that tells a pretty convincing story that it's clear that Baker has thrived without Odell for whatever reason that is.
So, Jake, I want to do some historical accounting real quick with you here because the Browns are one of four teams that have never, ever made it to the Super Bowl. The other three teams, the Lions, Jaguars, Texans, with the Chiefs on tap, with the winner of the Ravens-Bills game waiting for them, should they survive? How realistic is a Super Bowl looking to you?
If I answer that question, Browns fans will be very upset with me because there's one thing that they believe in more than about anything, and that's jinxes. And so you have to be very careful on their behalf not to jinx things like this. I will say this. I've talked to a couple people, and if the Browns made the Super Bowl hypothetically...
Hypothetically, yes, very clearly.
There are people in Cleveland who will sell their cars to go to the game. They will sell their houses to go to the game. And I'm not making a joke. Like, that's a fact, because they've been waiting their entire lives for that moment, and it would be a moment they would not miss.
Jake Trotter, thank you for hypothetically bringing hope to the city of Cleveland.
Thanks, Pablo.
Okay, up next, a visit to the other side of Lake Erie, where Bills Mafia is building new traditions instead of breaking tables.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. The Buffalo Bills are hosting their second playoff game of the year on Saturday, which is a big deal. Honestly, it's kind of the biggest of big deals in Buffalo. We're talking about fans who are famous for jumping onto and through folding tables at tailgates. That's a ritual which admittedly doesn't quite come across in audio.
Hey, hey, hey. Let's go, Buffalo!
It's also so very Buffalo Bills that they would finally make this kind of promising playoff run amid a pandemic when so many of those fans can't actually be around the game itself. So we caught up with ESPN's Bills reporter, Marcel Louis-Jacques, to hear how the city of Buffalo feels right now.
The way the city is celebrating around the pandemic is still, it's so fun to see as kind of an outsider to the community. I live in a neighborhood called Allentown. When I first moved here, I did think it was named after Josh Allen. I was wrong. But now it's actually named after Josh Allen. If you look at the sign, it says, "Welcome to Josh Allen Town." And it's like our version of the Vegas sign. You know, you go downtown, though, and City Hall, the same site where those Super Bowl parades ended and where moments like Scott Norwood addressing the city on the steps happened, you just see massive banners hanging down. Let's go, Buffalo. AFC East champions. You know, go Bills. The tallest building in town, Seneca One. It's this massive 80s-style rectangular monolith, and you can see this big Oxford pennant that says, "Let's go, Buffalo." Go Bills is literally looming over the city. I can't think of a better metaphor than that.
So I understand that tailgating has been banned for now, which is this enormous change, obviously, given the fan base you just described. But restaurants were, Marcel, hosting these watch parties outdoors for last weekend's game. And we got in touch with a local spot in East Aurora called Wall and Wines and the owner there, Ben Holmes, who told us what they did last week for fans and why.
I ended up with 33 tables. There were four per table. And that's the maximum right now allowed by New York State. So I had 132 people, you know, outside, completely out in the open, no tent covering, watching the game on a 7x10-foot LCD screen. Inherently, Bills fans just want to be around one another. You know, even if it is seated at a table of four and you're 7 feet away. You know, I mean, being in Buffalo, any wedding always has the shout song played at it. You know, it's amazing how much noise just 130 people can make in a parking lot that's, you know, 90x90. But yeah, there was definitely some banging. There was some yelling. The Bills make me wanna jump. You know, I think just the fact that people get to be close to other Bills fans really is what makes it special.
Now, we did learn, Marcel, after we talked to Ben, that Wally's had to cancel their viewing party this weekend due to the whole 10 p.m. New York State restaurant curfew thing. But does all of this fan behavior sort of fit in with what you've been learning about Bills fans in this particularly strange postseason environment?
It does. And while a lot of them have chosen to either go to a place like Wall and Wine or go to Chippewa Street, which was completely blocked off during the Bills game and had outdoor seating. Let me be very clear. Like, it was a nice day for Buffalo in January, but it wasn't a nice day for normal, you know, normal weather places. Like, it was still very much 32 degrees outside. Like, oh, the sun was out, but it was very freezing.
That's outside. Like a Buffalo 65, right?
Oh my God. I wouldn't be shocked if there were people in shorts. I know someone had their shirt off at the stadium that, I mean, he's just fulfilling his role in society. But I spoke to one Bills fan, Ken, whose game day kind of resonated with me because, like, it wasn't what you would expect. But if you know Bills fans, it's kind of exactly what you'd expect, if that makes sense. He didn't do the big party. You know, he didn't do some makeshift tailgate, or he's not crushing beers and jumping on flaming tables in the snow. He's very confident when they're up two scores. And then as Indy started to creep back at the end, he says,
"And then you get to that moment where it's like it's a Buffalo moment, and they started crawling back, and then it was, you know, Josh Allen fumbles at the end, and it's like, well, is he doing that? Is he making that mistake that everybody wants him to make?" And they managed to pull it off with the Hail Mary knockdown. So it was just a great experience, and I'm glad that I was with my dad, you know, able to experience that with him as well.
It actually made me think of you, Pablo, because of what we talked about last time I was on the show. And I was like, that's it. That is clairvoyant pessimism. That's it right there.
Clairvoyant pessimism. Absolutely. Oh, what a the pain, the joy that can never be without some amount of pain.
A Buffalo moment. Like, I've never heard it described like that.
Marcel, I want to pull back the curtain here a little bit on ESPN Daily, because our own producer, Aaron Vail, is, I think it's safe to say, a Bills Mafia don. She and her whole family are these diehard Bills fans, and her sister's dog is named Allen, and that's actually specifically intentionally named after Josh Allen. And her dad just got a COVID test, and so he's now going to the game. And he shared how the team making the playoffs is felt everywhere.
So you live in Orchard Park. It's 3 miles from Bills Stadium. We have walked that together. What's the vibe like in Orchard Park this week? How are people feeling? What have you been seeing?
When the Bills win, there's a different feel. And that's like that's the impact of that they have on the whole community. So it doesn't matter where you are. If I went into NoCo because I needed to buy some milk, there's a different feel. People are actually nicer. Right now, anywhere you go, you feel that we're in it. Like, and I can tell just by looking at you in this conversation, you know that we're in it. And that's pretty valuable.
And even with just a fraction of fans being there, Jim Vail is very excited to watch from Bills Stadium.
Any tunnel you walk in, you're totally surrounded by concrete, and then you see the green. Like you see, and if you're not getting chills right now, I don't know who you are. Like what have you done with my daughter? You know that moment, like when you see the field and you see the lights and you actually hear what's going on in the field. I'm really looking forward to that. You know, the national anthem, a flyover, all of it, just the idea of getting back.
So, Marcel, what would you say to a Bills obsessed family going into this game in your capacity as a Bills reporter? What wisdoms would you share with them?
Be prepared. Mentally, spiritually, be prepared. This is playoff football. These games are unpredictable. They go down to the wire more often than not. They are almost never over. Even if the Bills season ends on Saturday, I don't want to be that, you know, participation trophy, you know, you had a good year, pat yourself on the back. But just please be cognizant of what this represents, that for the first time in a quarter century, for the first time in an entire generation of fans' lives, they have seen a home playoff game. And not just that, but playoffs are once again the expectation. Even if that season ends on Saturday, just recognize that this looks like a return to normalcy in Buffalo. And that's a good thing for the league.
Marcel, our man in Buffalo, amid all of the attempts at clairvoyance, thank you for reminding us to, you know, enjoy the present.
Exactly. Stay grounded.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Troh, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Max Brodsky, Troy Farkas, Jackson Udjulo, Sania Blue, and Andres Soto. I'll talk to you Monday.